There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
What form is that? That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home, those boys.
That's... Yeah, they have asked for that, really.
You can laugh. I was the World Cup.
I'm a little bit of an idealist. But having said that, I want to be like me.
Well, you don't know what you're talking about.
What did you know?
I managed to stay alive for 6 days.
I'd say it to
your
face, and I'll say it to you now.
Come down Swanfield and we'll see them, won't we?
What you doing down here, you shawnee man?
The best tweet of the weekend arrived on Saturday afternoon during a surprisingly eventful day at the top of the Premier League. At AFC Beef writes, Liverpool and Man City are currently losing and Arsenal are winning. But you know it'll end up with Liverpool and Man City winning and Arsenal drawing. How right you were at AFC Beef. How right you were. Welcome everybody, World Service members. Those of you not yet World Service members. Great to have you all on board for Monday's Second Captain's Football Podcast. Hi there, Ken.
How you doing, Owen?
Oh, I'm doing very well, Ken. A lot of big Premier League stories to cover in your report on sport.
It was a pretty amazing day, wasn't it?
Well, Saturday was it, yeah.
See, you were right there at the hub.
Oh, the cold face, Ken. Premier Sports Studio, myself, Richard Dunn, David James.
It was Liverpool-Villa, was it?
We were doing Villa-Liverpool.
Liverpool, rather good.
Well, firstly, it was a nice little quirk of the fixture list that City were also playing at 3 o'clock. Because, you know, it's something else to keep an eye on. And we thought, that's good, because at the end of the game, we can... Surely, City are going to win 6 or 7-0, but... We at least have that to talk about in the context of Liverpool and City the following week. But what we weren't expecting was both Liverpool and Manchester City to be losing for most of the game and then eventually putting it out late, especially late in Liverpool's case. We are going to cover all that in the report on sport, but after that we're talking Shamrock Rovers, FAI Cup champions for the first time since 1987, thanks to a flawless penalty shootout against Dundalk, who were chasing a treble. Three of the four penalties that Rovers had to take were more or less top bins, and the winner from Gary O'Neill was gently rolled along the floor, putting the goalkeeper the wrong way. I was there.
It was a bit Eden Hazard. Oh, you were in there.
Well, I was there to run my eye over your pet project for 2019.
Which is?
Well, you're trying to get Jack Byrne into the starting lineup for the Denmark game.
Oh, yeah. What do you mean?
He was bloody good, Ken. he was bloody good. He's got an eye for a pass, says Jack Byrne.
As good as Alan Brown?
Or? Yeah, I think maybe on current form. He could even be above Alan Brown. Through balls, general trickery. At one stage early, and so the way the game developed was that Rovers took the lead in the last minute of normal time with a penalty, and then Dundalk somehow managed to equalise to send it to extra time. But there was a point in the first half, I think, of extra time it was, when Byrne just beat a man, his usual close control, beat somebody, got taken down. Very small moment in the grander scheme of things, but it was just at a stage when I thought, geez, Dundalk are going to drive on here, they've got the psychological advantage.
Yeah.
So even little bits like that were impressive, winning free kicks. Byrne was also the subject of a fascinating interview by David Snaid in the 42.ie in the run-up to the game. David spent time in Jack's family home with the player himself, his ma Jackie, sister Jodie, and longtime agent Graham Barrett, also a family friend, was there. Really good stuff. A typical quote here from his mum. It was absolutely amazing when he came home. He was just so different. He was happy. I mean, that's all we've ever wanted for you in your life, was for you to be happy. It doesn't matter where you are or who you are, once you're here with your mammy. Then burst out laughing, in brackets, you know. So there was a lot of this kind of stuff. His mum comes across brilliantly, and the whole interview is very touching. David Snaid is going to be in studio with us today.
It doesn't matter where you are as long as it's in a 1.5 mile radius of the Clonard
exactly.
Road.
Yeah, like most mothers.
A whole new way of doing journalism. It's brilliant.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Okay, Wolfie is in good voice. Well, that's good to hear, because this Wednesday on the World Service, we will announce the details of our December shows at the Liberty Hall Theatre. Easily the most fun we have all year as we celebrate 2019 with our beloved members. If you want to sign up to have first dibs on those tickets, you can do it now on secondcaptains.com/join. Sign up before Wednesday. The rest of you, those of you already on the World Service, those details on the way to you in just a couple of days. Let's report on some sport now, please, Ken.
Well, yeah, it was sensational. Sensational day of a sensational set of 3 o'clock Saturday kickoffs, and I guess we should start with Man City, because City, this was like a heartbreaking experience for City, coming back, winning a game at home when it looked as though they might be about to drop points, coming back, winning a game, and it ends up feeling heartbreaking. Did you see Guardiola at the final whistle?
I don't think I did.
Guardiola's response at the final whistle was interesting, because he seemed very angry and wound up. Yeah. And I think there'd been some incident with one of the Southampton coaches where Pep thought that they were doing a bit of gamesmanship earlier on and not giving the ball back to City quickly enough and wasting time and stuff. And then at 2-1 he was like, "Oh guys, you're ball. Do you want your ball, or you seem really attached to this ball, or maybe you want to hold this ball on for a few minutes there." There was all this kind of stuff right. was going on. And then he was angry. And I couldn't see who he was shouting at. I mean, probably Arteta. It's usually Arteta. But he was ranting and raving. This was at full time. Liverpool scored their winning goal about 2 minutes after that. Mm-hmm. And I thought, I wonder what the effect of that is on... I imagine it would have quietened him down a bit, but it wouldn't have... His mood, I don't think, was good. Like, and it's kind of... It's worse than a kick in the balls. Like, it's, you know, you it, actually nothing has changed, but it feels like, I can't believe this has happened.
Because of Liverpool.
It's similar to sort of conceding a last minute equalizer. That's sort of the net effect of the day on City. They've thought at first, oh no, we're making a mess here. Then they got back in, and then they're winning, and Liverpool is still losing. It's like, we're actually going to close it to 3 points, and next week we play them. We could be top. Mm. We could be top next Sunday. And instead, suddenly it's...
We could be 9 points down next
Sunday. Oh no, they've equalised. And then after the final whistle, because the Liverpool game had been delayed... was going on a bit later... It was then after they score, so it was like, oh, we haven't gained any points. It's literally like we've let in a goal. We've only got a draw when we thought it was a win. We've dropped 2 points. You know, it's cost us 2 points. So Guardiola afterwards was like, there was a question to him. I think the questions included, you know, the question basically, how well do you think you played today?
Hi, Pep. How do you think your team's playing at the moment? Are you pleased with them? You know, where you are at the stage of the season? How do you view where they are?
Quite good. But the way we play today is I'm so delighted, yeah. In general, we have a lot of points, so we face one team that 10 victories, one draw, so it's a lot of points more than us, so.
Yeah.
I'm so delighted. I'm happy, believe me.
So delighted. I don't think he was that delighted at all, actually. There's an interesting piece by Sam Lee on The Athletic, who kind of follows the City pretty closely. And some remarkable stats coming out of the game in terms of City's what happens to City in a game when they're not flowing in the usual way, and essentially plan B is crossing. You know, there's nothing wrong with crossing. You know, it's a good way to score. In fact, if it's how they scored their two goals yesterday, one cross by Walker for Aguero, one cross by Angelino to Walker. And, but a lot of other crosses, 57 of them. And this is the third highest, total, in Premier League crossing history.
Moisey's still top.
That was when Manchester United drew 1-2 2-all.
Was it 80 crosses or something?
It's 71 it has it here. I thought it was more, but I guess people maybe calculate crosses differently. This is the Opta. Data is 71 crosses. That's United drawing 2-2 with Fulham at home. And the second is Liverpool, 59 crosses in a 0-0 draw against Stoke. It's not usually a good sign. with this many crosses, is like a team that's run out of ideas is kind of just lumping it in there and hoping something happens. So of course, City are the first team, or the first team on that list. You'll find who won the game. They did win the game. But this has been a bit of a pattern. You know, it is a team, remember, that's been hit. Like, it's the team's been weakened by the injuries. Sané, you sort of forget about him. He's so important to them, or was so important. He's been out.
Except they were going to sell him.
I know, but I guess I know it was bizarre. But remember, the timing of his injury was such that they couldn't replace him when he got busted out. You know, what was the? I think it was just it was a charity Community Shield when it happened. I think the transfer window closes on the Friday after that,
right?
And they didn't kind of have enough time for it. Like, I mean, if you're talking about replacing Sané, it's a major operation, as they might say. And Laporte as well, of course, not there. So these are big losses for them. And there have been times this season they haven't quite looked as, you know, and obviously there's a 6-point gap. And Guardiola had already said something which became quite controversial in his post-match interview. Although, the way that it was reported, I didn't really understand why people took this meaning from it. For some reason, they were talking, this was interpreted as being a comment about Sadio Mane, but listen to it. The full question and answer is here, and you can see what you think Pep is actually saying.
I'm sure the players knew on the pitch with what was happening in the stadium. Everybody seemed to be tuned what was happening with the Aston Villa-Liverpool game as well. How aware were you with what was happening elsewhere? And I'm sure you've seen what happened at the end in that game.
No, it's not our business. So we arrived in the locker room, it was 1-1, and after 1-2. So what happened many times, and Liverpool has done in the last years, is because it's a special talent. Sometimes it's diving, sometimes it's this talent to score incredible goals in the last minute. It's a talent. So when it's one time, two times, so we were lucky. What happened in the last two seasons many, many times, they have a special character to do that. So nothing. So important is look ourselves, so we know which team we face. So in I don't know how many games I think 1-10 and draw 1. So big compliment, and next week we're going to Anfield.
Now, nobody mentioned Mane there. Mm-hmm. Now, Mane did score the goal, the winning goal in the game, and he also was booked for diving in the first half. But I didn't think Pep was talking about him. I thought he was talking about Liverpool, and he was saying either he's... meaning they, you know, he's not speaking his first language here. He's a special talent sometimes is diving, sometimes not he's diving, as in Mane's a special talent, he's diving, he's doing this, blah, blah, blah. I didn't think he was talking
about
Mane.
No, I'm with you there. Well, also, how would he, what, the Mane incident against Aston Villa happened while the Man City game was on. So
yeah.
I see, you know, even at the BBC reporting their own quotes from Match of the Day, mentioned sometimes diving, sometimes it is the talent scoring incredible goals. And then the next line is, Mane was booked by the referee in the first half on Saturday for simulation.
Yeah.
And then later scored the goal. But I don't see how he's talking about something, unless somebody had shown him that clip by the time he went and did his interview, which is always a possibility.
Well, Mane got the last minute penalty, remember, against Leicester, wasn't it? Mm. What was the other one? There's another last minute penalty that he got. Was it against Aurier or Tottenham?
Yeah. Oh, well then, yeah, maybe it is. Maybe it is Mane he's talking about. I mean, he is talking about Liverpool diving.
Yes.
Late to win penalties. So
yeah.
Maybe it is.
I mean, it's interesting that he would say diving is a part of it. I mean, you know, that's yeah. obvious, you can imagine it doesn't go down very well.
No.
The Liverpool match, this is the last question to Jurgen Klopp. I think it was Jonathan Northcroft from the Sunday Times. He's clearly on deadline, decides to ask Jurgen Klopp a question about body language. This is the response he gets.
Changed everything. I didn't like that. That's a good point. I didn't like the body language in the first half. That's exactly how it is. We were not like warriors. We were like players. That's okay. We have to play. But in the end, you have to win the ball back. That's what I said. We had 10 minutes. We lost balls. Had one counter press, which was, the impulse was right. Three players there, tried, but they came out. So it can happen, because it cannot be 100% successful with counter press. But on the other side, we were really... being here, being there, but don't finish the situation off. I don't know how long it took until we shot first time from distance. Maybe it was Ox, I'm not sure, you know, when he came on. That would mean then 60 minutes. That's quite a time. And so, yeah, body language is massively important. Absolutely.
I thought it was quite a good line to get you know, when you're fishing for a quote, at, you know, is there anything else I can throw in here? And he's like, we were not like warriors. We are just, we were like players, which is okay. But that's not what I'm looking for. I mean, this was absolutely unbelievable.
What part of it?
Just the fact they ended up winning this game. Yeah. You know, from the point of 87 minutes being 1-0 down to actually win the game, not just to equalize. And it really had that feeling of, oh, this is like, again, if you're Man City, you get that feeling of, you know, okay, next week is going to be a really big game. City win that, and yes, but
what about the argument?
They're at the point where they almost need to win that.
What about the argument that Liverpool have to stop leaving themselves in this position, and that if they play how they played against Aston Villa against Man City, they're not even going to be in a position to get a late winner.
Well, there is that argument, and these games have all been like, is it the last six matches? There've been 5-1 goal wins and a draw.
And winning ugly is fine, but I think winning pretty is even better. You know, if you're winning and you're playing good football, that's the ideal. The next best thing is this whole winning ugly thing.
Yeah, it's hard to know. Like, I mean, the best example of a team winning pretty, let's say, has been City. You know, in the sense of where they kind of go on these cruising runs where they're destroying teams. You know, just in the first half, and then it's kind of like, we can now play out the game in a fairly controlled way, and you know, it's not like a big stress, and everybody's feeling good. Whereas this, there's a kind of a good side to this as well in terms of the euphoric thrill of this run of form by Liverpool reminds me a bit of that. Remember the famous Manchester United run in of '96 with Cantona scoring goal after goal, winner after winner after winner, in a sequence of one goal victories.
As long as you keep putting it off, it's fine. I'm not saying that Liverpool winning only by a goal is problematic in and of itself, but particularly it happening quite early on in the season, like, you know, that we're in November. And again, the context, sometimes you're having these conversations with Liverpool and it's just hilarious. They're going so well that you're splitting hairs over what way they're winning games. I mean, I'm sure Liverpool fans don't care too much. But there's a long season ahead, and you just kind of get the sense that they need to find this extra gear to slip into earlier in games, because if you keep leaving yourself in this position for an entire season, surely you're going to end up dropping more points than you can afford to drop.
Well, look, I think another thing that might be said, you know, if you were standing there in the penalty area in front of the cop, speaking to a microphone to you know, the denizens of that famous old stand, you might hear people screaming back at you about Martin Atkinson.
Yeah.
So this is when we're finally, we do have to speak about VAR.
Yeah, let's not apologise for it anymore. It just has to be done.
It has to be done because it sort of completely dominated the entire weekend. Okay. And this game saw some stunning examples of it. I mean, the Liverpool game. Some really, what's going on here? Including one of the most spectacular VAR moments I've seen yet, in which the Roberto Firmino goal was ruled offside by Martin Atkinson. Now, I was watching, I was in Paris, Owen. I had a multi-screen setup. I think maybe it's legal to do this in France. I'm not sure. I didn't have Premier Sports in this place. I was just trying to find what I could on the internet. I could see this situation. So this goal goes in for you. It's like, oh, there's a goal. Oh, it's offside. Oh, okay, they're checking it. Oh, he's onside. You know, you see the image of Tyrone Mings apparently playing for me. If Firmino's behind him, it looks as though he's onside. And then they draw a line, and you can see, okay, he is onside. This goal is going to be given. And then, you're kind of like, what exactly am I looking at here? Yeah. These lines are appearing and sort of moving around, you know, but guided by an unseen hand, which we later learned was that of Martin Atkinson. And what appears to be happening is the construction of a new line, which is going to be showing that Firmino was offside in order to back the decision that's been made by the linesman, the assistant referee at the game. And this is literally what then proceeds to happen. You're kind of looking at it going, hang on a second, what exactly is this? These lines are kind of, you can see, This is a very strange situation.
Has anybody written a piece yet to explain how all this mapping works? Somebody smarter than I, so I can just read it and understand.
Well, there have been pieces claiming that, you know, oh, this is, if this line was accurate, then Firmino is over 7 feet tall. What's going on? You know, I mean, there's a kind of, think about the technical challenge of it. Somehow you're always going to be trying to get it, you're always going to be trying to read the 3D situation off a 2D image, you know. And you can't have a perfect a camera that's always perfectly in line with the offside line until you make a really fancy high-speed rail and the camera's just whipping up and down in line with the last defender, right? That's, I mean, I suppose it's possible, but like it seems kind of insane that we would build something like that. We don't have it. So there's always going to be this, like, we have to infer where the line of offside is, whatever. But this was just like, we're just watching this guy cheerfully falsifying evidence to support a conclusion that's already been made. And it's an interesting test of, do you kind of cry foul or do you just sit there dumbly and accept, well, they probably know what they're doing. Like I saw Andy Townsend was with Ryan Giggs in whatever channel this was at halftime. And Giggs was saying, well, I thought the goal was going to be given. And Townsend goes, we have to trust the technology. But the technology is Martin Atkinson.
Yeah, but we also have to trust his integrity as well. He's not cheerfully falsifying evidence. He's doing his job to the best of his ability.
Well, that's the problem.
But it just looks so bad on TV.
That is the problem. That is the problem. When you've got... Like, I saw Michael Cox, zonal marking, making this point on Twitter. He said, he put up a... He linked to a video of Chris Kamara, and he said, I can't remember hearing a pundit actually accuse an official of corruption before. So great that we've got VAR now to sort out this whole problem. And it's just Kamara going, well, I think someone involved in Stockley Park has just decided we don't want this to be a goal. But I mean, that is exactly what it looks like. So when you've got to see, the good thing about the previous flawed way of refereeing a game was that it was flawed. Like, so it accepted the impossibility of perfect accuracy. It's like, we're doing our best, but we can't possibly get everything. It's impossible. But it kind of accepted that the impossibility of it. So there's this area of, well, there's blind spots in the game. Mistakes will happen, and that's the way it is. But now, if there are no blind spots, if everything is seen, and the mistakes still happen, then it's like, well, hang on, what is going on here?
Yeah, I'm coming around to your point of view on this one, Ken. I think it's... The way it's being run in the Premier League, I think it's a load of bollocks, really, isn't it?
Yeah,
it is. What's the point?
And, you know, it's like you said, if you accept that the official, Martin Atkinson or whoever, is just he's a good guy trying to do his job, maybe he's a bit of a boomer when it comes to computers. He's a bit like, I don't really know how to work this.
Some of these guys might be playing catch-up.
You know, it's like, does this line, you know, he kind of fooling around with the controls. Okay, there's a bit of that going on. But, like, who has that assumption anymore? After a few of these, a few iterations of this, that assumption of good faith is being melted away very fast. And in what's being replaced by an assumption of, hang on, we're getting screwed here.
So it's having the exact opposite effect to what it's supposed to have.
It basically is. Now, why would what seemed to be happening in a lot of these cases is the VAR manufacturing or finding a reason to support the conclusion that the referee has issued or the official... You know, and the thing about a lot of these cases is that you can in most cases do that because most of these things are debatable. You know, so even something like, say, Dele Alli's handball for Tottenham against Everton, which you see it and you're like, well, they're going to give that penalty because that's been one of the big things since VAR came in.
His
that's always going to be a penalty.
Sort of up in the air.
Put your hand up like that. That's going to be a penalty. They view it 26 times and then they decide, nah, Yerimina is pushing him and he's sort of putting his hand up for some reason, like on the other side that Yerimina isn't on and whatever. It's like, it's just a kind of a weird, like, what? I don't get this, but it's like supporting the original decision. The Firmino thing was supporting the original decision. You can always find some reason to kind of go with that. It's the nature of a lot of these things. They're not really that clear. There's small details, there's subjective thing. Like, say, for instance, a good example is the Mane booking. Mane was booked for diving in the first half. We've mentioned this a couple of times. We haven't mentioned that. He didn't really dive. In fact, it was an almost identical incident to the one between Aaron Connolly, and I forget which Everton player it was. Holgate, maybe? I can't remember which Everton player had... Michael Keane.
Yeah.
It was a very, very similar incident whereby a defender is challenging forward in the box. There's a really small step on the foot by the defender onto the striker. And the striker then goes down. Ah, in Connolly's case, penalty. in Mane's case, booking for simulation.
David James thought it was a penalty. Was it James or Dunn? Whatever, we only had a short amount of time to talk about that one, but whichever pundit spoke on Premier Sports again said, no, that's a definite penalty. But it was interesting to watch a match of the day. They just glossed over it. They went, oh, yeah, that clearly, not even a Liverpool fan would claim that's a penalty. And I was thinking, you don't know Liverpool fans.
Oh, I think they would. I think they would. But, you know, it's as much a penalty as the Connolly one was. Yeah. Was it a yellow card? I would say definitely not, because if, you know, you're booking someone for diving and yet you can see the defender stood on their foot, then that's not really a dive. Yeah. Maybe he's trying to get a penalty here. Like in the way that Son, in the Everton game, remember there was this one for when Yerry Mina, I thought, fouled him. Like for Yerry Mina kind of went to tackle him, sort of missed, and then kind of hurled himself at him and eventually sort of caught his leg and brought him down. But Son had kind of skipped and, you know, what I mean is each of these incidents is debatable. But in each case, it appears that the VAR is just trying to find a reason to side with the referee. Now, you can imagine why that is. Like, Martin Atkinson's had a tough couple of weeks. He got overturned by the VAR at Arsenal. This is like such a rare experience, but also kind of a disgraceful one for a referee. It's like embarrassing.
It shouldn't be, though. Get over yourselves. Don't be embarrassed.
It shouldn't be.
But honestly, the whole thing when people have been refereeing up to now has been, well, it's very hard for the referee. Even when TV pundits are slamming decisions, often they'll say, look, it's hard for the referee. We've watched that five or six times to understand. So I think people do have a, you know, fair-minded people again have an understanding that it's difficult for the referee, and I don't know, maybe there is a stigma there with which there really shouldn't be, that they getting something overturned is a bad thing. Like, it's not like in rugby, they talk, this is my on-field decision, let's have a chat. Oh no, you've got that completely spectacularly wrong, no problem, I'll change it. Nobody goes, oh, I can't believe you got it wrong.
Well, you know what, it struck me, I was thinking about this over the weekend, and the rugby situation, right, it always begins, now this may be wrong because I don't watch enough rugby to be sure, but it tends to begin, as far as I can make out, with a direct question from the referee to the TMO or whatever, and he kind of says what he thinks happened, but wants to check some elements.
He makes a ruling. Yeah, he makes a ruling. So he'll say he'll say, I've called that a try. That's a try.
Yeah.
Is there any reason I can't award it?
Yeah.
Essentially, and in that case, it's usually going to remain unless it's an obvious knock on or something like that. But it certainly gives the benefit of the doubt. Whereas other times he hasn't seen it. This would particularly happen when there might be a few players in the way of a ball, as it's, you know, there's a load of lads going across the line together, and he'll say, is it a try? Yes or no? And you're looking at it as a supporting team, going, it definitely is a try, because I mean, look at the momentum. He's got it down there. But if the VAR or if the TMO can't see it, he just can't give it because that wasn't what he was asked. So it's all about the decision. It's the question
it's asked. But the referee is seeing, you can hear that he's a participant in the process, an active participant asking instruction. Whereas in this case, it seems as though they don't want to overrule a ref because the ref will be embarrassed. Poor old Martin Atkinson, he's been having a tough time of it. You know, sure, Ole Gunnar Solskjaer called him the man of the match. I think well, it was him, wasn't it? But then, you know, you've got like Liverpool fans demanding an inquiry, Everton fans demanding an inquiry, Tottenham fans demanding an inquiry into Atkinson. Arsenal, you know, he's been made a fool of at Arsenal. Now the man is under siege, right? And remember, this is like a professional group. He'll be the VAR the next day, the referee. You know, there's a kind of, you don't want to screw someone over who's like a professional colleague. There's that instinct is there, especially if you can find a reason to support them, because they're going to be pissed off. You know what I mean? If you overrule them on some debatable way, they'd be like, Martin Atkinson could be, or not just him, anyone, be confronting them the next day. What do you mean? Making a fool of me over this. What are you doing? And especially when a referee is kind of under a bit of siege, you know, it reminds me of like the, you know, we had Tom Holland in the other week. He has in that book that we were talking about, an account of, you know, Galileo got in trouble with the Catholic Church for saying, oh, well, obviously the earth revolves around the sun. I mean, anyone who thinks otherwise is a moron. And then it's like, well, you know, strictly speaking, you know, the scripture might have a few issues with that. Can you prove it? Can you absolutely prove it? Well, I'll work on that. I'll work on that and I'll bring it to you. But anyway, the Pope ended up saying, oh, no, hang on. We're not having this. You better recant. I mean, fancy getting burned? No, didn't think so. So you're going to recant. You're going to live out your days in shame. And this is always one of these big stories of like, oh, the Catholic sort of tyranny, or, you know, this is this medieval fundamentalist stupidity. But he kind of portrays it more as like almost a thick of it type of scenario, where the thing you got to remember is that the Pope is in a Martin Atkinson type of situation, right? The 30 Years' War is going very badly for the Catholics. People are questioning his authority willy-nilly, and he's just not in the mood for any more of this at this time. You know, Galileo's been saying this for a few years, but it's not until the Pope really comes under pressure that he's like, I can't have this. You need to shut your mouth right now. You know what I mean? So it's sort of, the circumstances are always...
I think I know what you mean.
They're always... someone who's under siege is not going to brook any challenge to their pathetic authority, their crumbling authority. So this is the way with a few of these refs at the moment. But how long have we been talking about this now? 20 minutes. Like, it's bullshit. Like, and it's demeaning because the details are all so small that anyone who's arguing about them, and we have to because they're deciding the matches, just is like a... Like, it's so trivial and dull.
It is. It's lowering the level of football discourse.
Yes.
It really is. It's giving you... Everyone always argued about decisions, but because it was open-ended and there was no right or wrong answer, you could just go at it all day and everyone has their own opinions. Whereas now, it's still like... It's just more repetitive now. It's kind of like just variations of the same thing over and over again, it seems to me. Anyway, but then also, you do start getting conditioned to it. A friend of mine said Sports Liverpool was watching the Carabao Cup game and there was an incident during it. I don't know if it was an appeal for a penalty or something, and he was like, oh, well, VAR, I'll give us that. That's okay. You know, I'll sit back here and wait for... Oh, wait, there is no VAR in this in this match. You know, it's just, you're used to watching it through that prism now.
Yeah.
So maybe eventually we will all just become conditioned to it.
Maybe we just get rid of the ref altogether.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, is self-refereeing, self-regulation an option? Maybe not. I mean, the other thing, the bad thing that happened on the weekend was the awful injury of Andre Gomes. Even that turned into a VAR situation. Because again, it was Martin Atkinson, for all Martin Atkinson. He's there, he sees Son did this tackle, then this, you know, Gomes goes over and Aurier comes in with another tackle and they're on the ground and he's not even looking at that. He's just booking Son for like a dangerous tackle and a bit of a tactical foul. And then everybody realizes what's happened to Andre Gomes. Oh my God, it's a horrific injury. And everyone's got their head in their hands and starts crying and all this. And then Atkinson is like, well, pulls out the red card and sends Son off. It's like, well, we've seen the consequences of your actions. And it's like, Son doesn't really deserve the red card. Unless you were to change the rules that this type of challenge is dangerous. They put out a statement afterwards, again, sort of backing up Atkinson.
Yeah, and
saying that endangering his opponent.
Endangering his opponent, and also that the severity of the injury was a consideration.
Yeah. Which
I didn't realise. I thought it's a foul is a foul, and what happens afterwards is...
But I suppose it's like, you know, if you were involved in a car accident and... You know, and the worst that happened was that, like, someone's wing mirror got knocked off.
Yeah, I know.
It's different if someone gets badly injured, you know, it's...
Of course, yeah, no, of course. But that is the law. I mean, this is football. You can kind of make it up whatever way you want to.
Yeah, it's tough on... So, I mean, it's tough on Andre Gomes, really. I mean, I saw Dele Alli giving a big interview afterwards going, oh, sorry, he's absolutely just shot. And I was thinking, after a while, as he went on about what a great guy Son was and how down he was, I was kind of thinking, shut up talking about Son. Like, I'm sure he's upset, but at the same time...
Not as upset as the player.
Yeah, but like, again, are Tottenham going to appeal that? It's a three-match ban, like, for Son now, which I don't think he really deserves. We'll see how that one works. There was some football.
Yep.
Big Shark, Leicester. Remember Mendy talking about Man City, we're the Big Shark team. Leicester are the Big Shark team now. Brendan Rodgers, so smooth and assured. And actually, looking through the team, it's like good players in every position. Like, they're really good. Most obviously, of course, Jamie Velociraptor Vardy.
Oh, of course, yeah. I mean, I just can't believe Jamie Vardy got stuck into the Albania-Kosovo-Serbia conflict.
Oh, how do you mean by his...
It was goal celebration. He did that eagle thing.
Oh, that's what it was?
No, I don't. I think it might have been the... Eagles being the nickname of Crystal Palace.
Of Crystal Palace.
Who knows? Who knows what way Jamie Vardy was leading with that one?
Well, I was when I saw Vardy doing that flapping.
Wasn't that what Shaqiri did? Yeah. Anyway,
there was only one. It was Shaqiri and Xhaka.
Yeah,
they were the two players. They didn't. In fairness, do this big exaggerated arm flapping. They did more of a like a Nicolas Anelka goal sort of. You know where you link the thumbs together and you sort of flap the wings with your hands. That's the. But when I saw Vardy Jr., I could only think of one line.
But you never look at birds the same way again.
That's Jamie. I mean, what a player. Look at how he leads.
What a long wing. He seems to have long arms and long hands.
Well, he's just a long, bony, velociraptor shaped man.
I don't know what these clips are.
Look how he leads. You don't know what that is? No. That's Sam Neill in Jurassic Park.
Oh.
When they're saying the Tyrannosaurus Rex for the first time. But yeah, they're going really well.
Yeah.
So they play next week, Arsenal. Next weekend. And this could be like the final showdown for Unai Emery, because I mean, people are saying, well, he's got to go. It seems like most of the Arsenal crowd, I saw Ars blog had put a poll up, there's like 50,000 votes, 88% go now. You know, I think 6% were like, give him another game or something like that, you know. But the rumors came out, or Duncan Castles had a story in the Sunday Times saying that Arsenal's directors, some of them had met Mourinho, dined with him. Arsenal now saying, nah, suddenly he did not meet Mourinho for dinner. No such meeting took place, and the pair have not spoken for many years. So I don't know if they fell out or what the reason is. But just the hilarious notion that Mourinho... like that Arsenal could hire Mourinho now.
Saw you writing about this today. You said in some ways it could be quite fitting.
Well, you know, just if things are really going to go bad, this is one way to really, if you're interested in testing yourself, just how bad can things get here? Bring in Jose, because he might be just imagine what he'd do. Like, it would be, I mean, you see how kind of nasty things can get. Like, and the sort of constant splits in the Arsenal fan base, and like the war, like the perpetual war that's going on. And imagine then Mourinho presiding over all this and stoking it up.
I prefer really not to speak.
I don't think they will hire him. I don't think they're crazy enough to do it. But I also don't think Emery's going to be there much longer. I mean, the Xhaka thing, he looked bad at the end of it. He said immediately after Xhaka, he's wrong. 5 days later, Xhaka still hasn't apologized. He puts out a non-apology apology. Emery's like, well, he's apologized now. It's like, no, he hasn't. Then he's not in the team, but Ozil is. Ozil's in the team. Like, only last week, you were saying the entire hierarchy has decided as one not to play him in important games. Now he's almost immediately, it's just like this impression of weakness and like,
yeah,
it's not. And they put out a tweet yesterday, happy birthday, Unai, 48 today. And the reply is like,
Sean Broderick said, hi Ken, just a short note to say, hi lads, short note to Ken to say, great article today. On the theme of
much.
Players like Xhaka getting it in the neck, I was thinking about Richard Keogh last week and his treatment by Derby. The prevailing mood I saw on journal comments and Twitter was good enough for him. I couldn't believe it. When did the common man start siding with clubs over players, companies over employees? Would love to hear your thoughts on it this week. Thanks, Sean.
Well, that is interesting, all right. And you do see a bit of that. I mean, I guess we're all subjected to a lot of propaganda, you know?
Well, in fairness, a lot of the reaction that I saw was the opposite. It was how can they get rid of Richard Keogh and keep the other lads, keep the lad who was driving the car playing away at the club?
Yeah, I mean, I think, like, we are all... What, if there's that question, you can consider that question generally and then specifically in the case of Keogh, and it's slightly different, I think. In general, I suppose we all marinate in this propaganda the whole time. The election at the moment that's going on in the UK is quite interesting, and this team of billionaires has become sort of big because like Labour are sort of pushing this line of there shouldn't be any billionaires. Like the existence of a billionaire is a sign that something has gone badly wrong with your society and your economy, and we should not have this. And then you got like loads of people going, well, so just Harry Arter actually got involved in this. Bizarrely, Jeremy Corbyn tweeted, there are 150 billionaires in the UK, while 14 million people live in poverty. In a fair society, there would be no billionaires and no one would live in poverty. Mm-hmm. I think, quite uncontroversial. Harry Arter thinks, he responds to someone who puts up a tweet like, in the Premier League, there are 6 teams with a realistic chance of being champions, and the rest just make up the numbers. In a fair society, there would be no champions, and, you know, blah, blah, whatever. And Harry Arter evidently thinks this is a good point, and chips in going, also, I'm pretty sure them billionaires create thousands of jobs for the public through their numerous of companies. Is just a ridiculous statement, basically saying, don't strive for greatness. Zzz, like sleeping emoji. Mm-hmm. a few people got onto him about this, you know, taking. I think Arthur's argument, that was a good example of this mindset that the person who emailed us is talking about, you know, taking the side of, say, the rich and powerful. You know, this idea of a billionaire is not a symptom of a rigged economy, but rather someone who's striven for greatness and is now a wealth creator, providing thousands of jobs for the public.
Lee Westwood said something similar.
Yeah, of course. I mean, lots of rich people sort of think this way. I mean, obviously, when you're rich, you want to think of yourself as being a, you know, a wealth creator, as opposed to like a vampire squid or whatever the alternative, whatever the other opposite point of view is. But Harry Archer then says, people are like, oh, that's a stupid point. Or, you know, I didn't see all the tweets to him. But he then comes out with, the same Corbyn that openly admitted he lied through the whole campaign the day after Brexit about what he was planning to invest in the NHS. Chin rubbing emoji. And I thought, that is a well-chosen emoji, because this is one of the craziest things I've ever seen on the internet. What? The same Corbyn that openly admitted he lied through the whole campaign the day after Brexit about what he was planning to invest in the NHS. Okay. He then follows up with, hard to take anything he says seriously, this is Corbyn, when his whole campaign was on the back of a certain amount of new funding for the NHS, to then literally the next day admitting it was all a lie. And you're like, this is unbelievable. Oh, I was, look at this guy. Is this really happening? This is Harry Arthur. Like, I've seen this guy play for Ireland. He seems to think that Jeremy Corbyn spent the Brexit referendum going around telling everybody he was going to, I guess he's the NHS promise he's talking about is, we send 350 million a week to the EU, let's fund our NHS instead.
Yeah.
This was, of course, the Vote Leave slogan, the Boris Johnson campaign. So Johnson was the one saying this, and the person who, the day after Brexit, that Arthur refers to, who went on TV and said this NHS thing was a lot of bollocks, was Nigel Farage. Yeah. Nigel Farage was on like Piers Morgan's show and said, well, it's a mistake. Now, you have to remember, Farage, his campaign was leave.eu, not Vote Leave. So his campaign wasn't actually the one saying, let's give 350 million a week to the NHS. It wasn't his promise that he was disavowing. That was the other Brexit campaign. His campaign was the one saying, we're at breaking point. We need to stop these migrants coming in. Mm. That was his.
But either way, that wasn't
either
Jeremy
way,
Corbyn.
It was the opposite side. It's like these are actually among the most famous political acts of Boris Johnson, and in the one case, the 350 million a week. It's one of the most famous things he's ever been associated with. And Farage the next day saying, nah, it's a mistake. That's one of the most famous moments of the referendum. And somehow Harry Arthur thinks Jeremy Corbyn was responsible for both of these things and is now blaming him and considers him a fraud because of what... Honestly, it's like a level of misinformation that I could never have imagined. It would never have occurred to me that somebody could be this badly informed.
Oh, but this isn't even deliberate misinformation. I don't think anyone has tried to peddle this.
No.
Somebody getting very confused about what's been going on. This is why Gareth Bale just sticks to golf again.
This is why we're in big trouble. Yeah. things are not looking good. Things are not looking good. But just to get back very, very briefly to the email, the specific case of Kyo.
We never actually talked about that in the end.
No.
Last week, the way the timings worked.
The other thing about it is, like, it was like a kind of a reckless scene that he was involved in, you know? And when we talk about sort of propaganda that we absorb, we also see a lot of stuff about, like, drink driving, reckless behavior on the road, the terrible consequences of this, you know? And we see enough of that to kind of feel as though when someone's involved in something bad after reckless behavior, they kind of deserved it a little bit, you know? Nobody deserves terrible injuries, but like, we all know that this is not the kind of thing you should do. And obviously he's not the one who was drink driving, but he was in the group and he's the captain. You know, there's a sense in which people might think it's a bit rich for him to think that he can pick up like more than £1 million for, you know, after putting himself out of action in this way. I can kind of see it from the club's point of view. And he also is a highly paid footballer. He's not quite the common man. There isn't really that empathy with these players. You know, when you know they're sort of rich and, you know, all this sort of... We were talking on Friday about why fans kind of hate players anyway. You know, they're rich and they're jealous of them and it's annoying. And then one of them does something like this and it... You can say, well, there's an argument that he did it to himself. Well, you know, he didn't.
But the specifics of the Kyo story, the reason that some people might say he's been unfairly treated is because it's in comparison to the players who were drinking and driving also on his team and are now back playing for that team. And, you know, the appearance would be that those players are a lot younger, have a lot more value to the club, whereas the guy, you know, you say in one case he should be a leader, he's older or whatever. Yeah, but also because he's older, he has less value to the club.
Yeah.
And he's nearing the end of his career, certainly nearing the end of his career with Derby, was near the end of his career with Derby County. And therefore, it looks like it's the easier call for them to get rid of him and let the other lads play away.
Yeah, I mean, it seems totally unfair. I mean, that is how it looks. That's how it looks. The decision has been made. It seems unjust, but again, there's another example maybe of that. Sometimes the consequences of the same behaviour can be worse, and the punishment, the payment, what it costs you ends up being much more, even though really it's sort of the same behaviour.
That's it for today's Report on Sport.
I lost!
Yeah.
Fuck's sake, I don't want to lose it.
They shouldn't interview you now.
Wait, I don't want to lose it, I'm fucked up.
You're playing shit.
In 10 minutes, I'll be all right.
They shouldn't
interview you now.
So I better go now. Or first, I ask some coaches questions.
It's too late now.
What's that? Are you interviewing me or not? Seriously? Come on. Is there an explanation for this? Is there an explanation for this?
You could be my mama and I'll be your boy.
Original road boy, never my coy.
We know you as a very good dart player.
I'm not playing shit.
Fuck's sake, I don't want to lose him.
But is there an explanation for that, or?
No, of course it's not. Of course it's not.
How do you prepare for the last match then?
These are the questions that you should be asking when we're live.
Oh, we're live now.
We're not live now.
Yeah, we're live. There you are on television. I'm serious. Yeah.
Why wasn't I told?
Sorry?
Should have been told.
Oh, I thought you know.
Well, do I prepare? I'll prepare the same. If I win, I win. But I cannot keep playing like this. This is no good.
David Snaid is here to talk about the FAI Cup final, which saw Shamrock Rovers win the cup for the first time since the 1980s, believe it or not. Hi, David.
Morning, how are you?
Deserving winners, do you think?
Yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah. Over the course of 90 minutes, extra time, and then obviously penalties, they had the team had a bit more about them on the day. Yeah.
It was petering out a little bit. Well, it looked like it was going to peter out to a nil-all draw, then go to extra time and potentially penalties. Rovers, then, for people who didn't see it, scored a penalty in the last minute of normal time to win the game, presumably. Somehow Dundalk, I don't know how they did it, found the time to go up and get an equaliser, which gave us a nice bit of drama for the occasion.
And following in FAI Cup final tradition in the Aviva, because it's just been like that constantly since the final's been there, it's been great.
Well, it was going to be 4 out of 5 ending 0-0. I was looking at it, I was like, this seems to happen a lot. Like, they always got the extra time in this. But like, it wasn't 4 out of 5 because obviously it ended 1-1. But a lot of nil-all draws, isn't it? And it always seems to be really cold as well.
The last, obviously, the previous 4 finals have all been, it's always bitter. But I'm actually coming down with a cold now, which is great. But the last 4 finals in a row were Dundalk-Cork, And obviously, they were the two teams for the last 5-6 years who have been the standard bearers, really, in the League of Ireland. And they were two teams. So you had Dundalk who would try and get the ball down, try and play it, and then you had Cork who just wanted to suffocate them and were really, really good at it. Like some of their, to use a rugby phrase, their intensity in those games, Cork, or Dundalk just couldn't match Cork. So this way was actually intriguing to see how this game was going to play out, because Dundalk have had the better of Rovers in the league. You know, Rovers only took 1 point off them, and that was the first game of the first meeting of the season. But yeah, it was just like Rovers. It was a bit of a setting down a marker in the fact that you come to a cup final and Rovers were in control of the game, Now, obviously, Dundalk were missing Chris Shields. They hadn't got Patrick McElhinney, and that forced things to change. But it was really impressive from Rovers in the sense that they just looked... They looked as if they had maybe a better striker, they could have maybe won that game comfortably.
What struck me was, after conceding that goal at the end of normal time, the equaliser, you're then going into extra time. And that's where, particularly given that Dundalk have the experience of winning, they were the team going for the treble. Yeah. I kind of thought, and I was in there with my Rover supporting mates and all the rest of it, and it was a little bit, there was quite a lot of
I thought as the game wore on, and it was actually in the second half, it became a bit more even. like, even though Rovers still had two good chances, like, I think Gary Rogers made an absolutely unbelievable save from Graham Bourke, but the ref gave it as a goal kick. Like, but when you look it back, he gets a hand to it. It was a fantastic save. But as the game wore on, I started thinking, Dundalk will nick this. You know, like, they are the team who have the know-how and have been in these situations, but not just in the cup final or in the cup, but in the league and in the big games. Dundalk always know how to get the job done, and that's why it was so impressive, and that's why it was actually, even though in fairness to them, they came back and they got that goal, which was fantastic, by Michael Duffy in the 93rd minute. But like, that goal from Rovers, like the move, it's very rare to see a goal of that calibre maybe so late in it in any game really, because like, it's tired bodies, I suppose. But like, the turn from Bourke where he just kind of let Gartland come in and then just took it off him and then played the perfect weighted true ball. He could have easily, it was tired, like, he had a reasonable game. He could have easily overhit that pass for Aaron Green. And even Aaron Green making that run, who his game would be more so about kind of coming to the play and linking and stuff, but making that run in, it was just a great, really good goal.
How big a moment was this for Shamrock Rovers as a club? I mean, obviously they have won tons of trophies over the years, but I certainly got the sense that there was a lot of emotion around it. It had been so long since the cup had been since they'd won a cup, that there seemed to be, and the sense that this isn't just some sort of fluke where you might win this cup and then go away. There's a sense that they're building something. There seems to be a lot of emotion around the occasion, certainly from where I was in.
Yeah, like, with Rovers in the cup, there's always that emotion, because up until then, it's always been talking about the kind of, they're the cup kings, you know, like, that was their, they've now got the drive to 25, they've got there. But speaking to Stephen Bradley, this wasn't a case of, this is the pinnacle. Like, this is, so what Jose Mourinho always said when he came to England, you win the League Cup and then that kind of helps as a bit of a catalyst for the rest of the season almost. But like, this is definitely kind of the start of what Rovers need to be doing, because since Michael O'Neill left, they went through managers. Like, they got rid of Kenny after 9 months when things were struggling. Like, the fans, even the fans last year with Stephen Bradley, like, they had a banner out to get rid of him. Like, he said he had enough, you know, because
how long ago was that?
That was only last season. I think could have been the back end of the season before, but
I think he even noted that recently in program notes. A couple of weeks ago, he was like, you lads kind of had a bit of a, you know, thing out for me last year.
And he made the point as well, where he even said, like, people will say about the project, and it is something that's been flung at the club, and it is an easy job. And when you think about it, like, he actually is right, where, like, Rovers have come in and they're not the only club to have an academy or to invest in an academy and the youth teams, but they've been very good at getting that message across. And that's maybe almost sort of like rub people up the wrong way, that they're so keen to actually say, well, this is what we're doing. And then people will have a go at them for doing exactly what every club in this country should be doing. So, like, I'm not a Rovers fan, but I don't think you can sort of kind of criticise them for the way they've been going about their things. Maybe it rubs people up the wrong way that they're so keen to actually say, well, this is what we're doing. And like, Stephen Bradley, and you had Stephen McPhail talking about the project. Like, there was a really good moment, I referenced it just in my piece I did for the Irish Examiner today, where, like, we just looked at Bradley at the final whistle and he seemed quite calm. Like, people were jumping on him and going ballistic on him, and he kind of wanted to kind of almost compose himself. He went over to Vinnie Perth, and then it was only when really he saw Stephen McPhail, literally, it was like, what's that film where Patrick Swayze, God rest him, what's it?
Dirty Dancing.
Literally, he ran into...
That is the film, right?
Though. Yeah, but he ran into Stephen McPhail, wrapped his legs around him and gave him a big hug. Like, and you could just tell that and Shane Robinson, who obviously works in the background with the academy, but for McPhail and Bradley, it was sort of the first part of justification for what they're trying to do. And... yeah, like, it does bode well for the future, because that group of players they have as well, it's not just young lads. Like, like, even though we're talking about the academy, like, they've got, like, lads there who are in the prime of their career and who are experienced as well.
They've got an international, senior international, who you did a great piece with.
They actually had five internationals and one on the bench. You know, six internationals.
Current senior international. you and I think Dan McDonald got to spend a bit of time with
Jack Byrne.
With Jack Byrne and his family.
And Jackie Byrne, more to the point.
And Jackie,
his mum.
Oh, yeah, the star of the show.
Yeah.
Yeah, how was that?
It was brilliant. Yeah, it was actually, it was really good. I've never actually kind of, I did a piece with Alan Moore, who used to play for Middlesbrough, last season. Went over and spent the weekend with him and his whole family, but that was a bit different. That was his wife and his kids. This was, literally going into a lovely little house and just off Clonliffe Road, and it was just fantastic. Like, it was come away from it. I remember, I don't mind saying, it was the first time I actually ever transcribed an interview, and like, was crying a little bit just from kind of when she was talking about the scene when Jack.
This is Jack Byrne's mother.
Jack. Yeah, Jackie. When she was talking about the scene when Jack got the first call up for Ireland. And it was Paddy's Day, and she was in the pub with her daughter Jodie, who was also there. And Jack Byrne bursts in, and she thinks that he's like, ma. And she this farts gas. Typical Irish man, like, the first thing she thinks is that he's crashed his car or something. And like, but then he just starts roaring and crying in the public. That yeah. he tells her he got a call up. And then even going on that, like, the fact that like she has obviously for people don't know, Jack Byrne's dad died of cancer when he was 11. And he went to Man City when he was 14, but then
the ashes,
like, oh. And she has it in the pouch, and I was like,
she's brought it around to games, and she's like, talking
stop.
To
her. Like, yeah. And even when she was, even
you're
when
you're getting me now,
like, even when thing. She, even when she was saying it, I'm like, when I was listening back, I was like, oh my god, like, because I was actually transcribing it, and my own son, who was like 14 months, was just like got around the kitchen like a little lunatic, and I was looking at him, and I was like, I can't cope with this. Like, I actually
hit home, there was loads of great bits, but the overall theme of it, I think, was how happy he is. Obviously, how happy his family are that he's home, and how amazing it is for anybody to make their Ireland debut, and how big that is for a family. That was really driven home. But the idea of a player, particularly one who was at Man City as a young player, coming home and playing the League of Ireland up until relatively recently, would have had all these negative connotations towards that, and it might be hard to adjust, and are they going to be seen as a failure and all that. Whereas this seems to have been just like a massive fill-up to him. He was in a bad way in Scotland. He's come back, and it seems like living at home or being at home. And I don't know if he's staying. I don't know what the plan is for the next couple of seasons, but he just seems to be in a great place.
Yeah, definitely. Like, and actually, you mentioned there about Dan McDonald. Like, the Indo summed it up perfectly with their headline where he said, like, the resurrection of Jack Byrne, because he went away at 14, and he said himself in the interview, it's making up for lost time. Like, he's back in the house and just being around family. I remember James Ryan, obviously, the rugby player, talking about this, where he just said, like, what's helped him kind of progress in his career with Leinster and Ireland is the fact that he doesn't have to worry about a lot of stuff. Like, he can just, he's living at home with his man. His man drops him in to training and stuff, and all he has to worry about is football, you know? Whereas with Jack Byrne, where they were discussing that the last club he was in Britain was Kilmarnock, because he was at Oldham, things were going reasonably well, and then, as is the way, they went through money difficulties, weren't paying players, and for financial reasons they had to get him off the wage bill, because he was their highest earner. And so he goes to Kilmarnock, can't get into the team because they're doing well, and he's depressed. Like, they said it, like, he said it, his ma said it, you've never seen him like that. And his ma was the one, Jackie was the one who got him back. And like, At the start of this season, talking about kind of those negative connotations, at the start of this season, I went out to Blanchardstown to interview Danny Mondrew at Bowes, Darry Leahy, Robbie McCourt, and Luke Wade Slater, because they're four lads who all played for St. Kevin's, like Jack Byrne, but were the same age, well, similar age, and all went to England and all came back, and all this season were turning 21 within the space of a couple of months. And I was speaking to them, and Danny Mondrew, who this season he's probably going to get Young Player of the Year, I imagine. Like, in the Ireland under-21s, is like some of the goals he scored this season, it's like savage. He was saying that he went back around Ballymun and was getting called a waster. You know, so like, he's 20 years old, he's gone over, things maybe haven't worked out exactly how they like, and he's getting deemed a waster at 20. What's he done wrong? Like, he hasn't won the lotto, essentially, because that's basically what it is once you go over there. He's done absolutely nothing wrong, but then he feels as if he's a failure, you know, and that's why this season with him, there's so many players who are just lost, and I think I've said this before on here and other places, where so many young lads are just lost to football because they go to England because that's all that's what they seem is what they have to do, and then when they come back, they're like, well, they just don't know what to do. Like, some of them just don't want to be involved in the League of Ireland because they see it as kind of that's accepting defeat or something. Yeah. But it's just. Like,
it's certainly different with Jack. Yeah, Jack Byrne seems to have a different perspective on it.
Also, someone who's in that piece is Graham Barrett, who's Jack Byrne's agent, and seems to be on very good terms with the family and so on. But I'm sure he's got a plan for the career. I mean, I wonder what you think the next step is. I mean, this has been a great season for him. He's played good football. He's got into the Ireland team or squad. Certainly, he played for Ireland. You know, scored a nice penalty, won the cup yesterday. So that's about as well as it could go, I suppose. But what's the next phase of this? Like, is it a case of, what I'm asking is how long
does he stay here?
In the plan, does he stay? Yeah, I mean, is it possible?
Hope Jackie Byrne's not listening to this, Ken.
I know. Have you got to a point where it could be like, well, I'm staying here? I mean, is that realistic?
Do you know, like, I don't know. Like, if you're looking at it, if you're going back by the pattern of the last 15, 20 years, are if a player is doing really well in the League of Ireland, he is 9 times out of 10 going to go and get a move either to England. But in Jack Bourne's case, like, he's been there, he's done that. He went to City, he went alone to Camborne, Holland, and that seems to have been where he had the most influence on a club in his career, although he did well at Oldham. But he's played in the lower leagues in England. So he knows when he's going over there. Like, he doesn't need the money. Like, he's made a few bob from those contracts at City. Like, I know he's not financially dependent. But
I know what you're saying, but you know, the money is always... If you're a professional footballer, you potentially have the opportunity to make a lot of money, but only for a few years.
Yeah. No, but listen, he is, and I'm, like every footballer, you'd imagine, an ambitious fella and wants to play at the highest level. Like, he's got a taste of the Ireland squad now. But, like, realistically, and it is at the moment, it's the fact of the matter is, if he's to actually kind of kick on to the next level, he will have to leave. But it's getting that right club, you know, like, there's no point in him going over to a club and say, let's say the Championship, and the ball's going over his head for 90 minutes in a match. Like, look beyond that, like, and he obviously, because of what he's been through, you would imagine that Graham Barrett and, like, I don't have any inside knowledge on this at all, but, like, you would imagine that Graham Barrett and him would have sat down and say, well, listen, the next move of his career is so important. Like, it has to be the right one. He has to find a club where, if he is going to move, where he can kick on again. Not that he play to a strength, because he has to go into a club, and he will, because the player he is, prove himself at whatever club he goes to, and be good enough to actually say, well, yeah, this is what he can kind of provide to a club. Because, like, he's obviously a very talented player, but no one's going to just come in and say, we're going to change our style of play and build everything around you, because that's just not how it works. Like,
Alan Manis, the Rovers goalkeeper, saved one of the penalties. Didn't he save one of the penalties?
Two.
And then, one hit the bar, didn't it? And then he got his hand to one, nearly saved it. He actually made a really big save at the end of extra time as well. So he's been a big figure for them. According to the Belfast Telegraph, a row has erupted as Northern Ireland international Alan Manis refuses to face the Irish flag during the national anthem in Dublin. So there's a picture of all the Rovers players looking towards the flag as the anthem's going, and he's standing straight ahead. This is former Linfield player, Northern Ireland international, Alan Manis. I mean, the row, insofar as the article states, seems to just be social media. People having to go,
Did either of you notice it at the time, at the game?
No.
You were at the wrong angle, though. When you were looking up the line,
I noticed, and a few other people noticed, and it was pointed out, and I sort of thought, just face the flag. Like, what's the issue? But then, like, let's be honest, like, who cares? Like, James McLean, like, it's poppy season.
It's the obvious.
He is, yeah. So, like, who cares? Like, it doesn't have to. Like, it's in the AV.
McLean did it in preseason
in Austria, wasn't it?
It was in America.
Was it America? Okay.
I think it was the exact same thing.
It was basically
the same thing, except with the exception that McLean didn't know the anthem was going to be played. Like, the national anthem is not usually played before a club game, but, like, the Americans do that kind of thing. They thought it was, oh, here's a nice gesture. Let's play God Save the Queen for this West Bromwich Albion. And I think it was West Brom. Yeah. And McLean suddenly heard this, and, like, they were all standing there, and then he heard this, and you could see him reacting. And then he kind of whipped around, turned 90 degrees, put the head down, hands behind the back, and, you know, was like, I'm not. And I kind of thought, like, why are you even bothering with this? Like, just go along with it. Like, it's not important. He obviously...
It's important to him.
It's important to him. And now, I guess, you know, Alan Manis is in a situation where he knows all about that McLean incident, and McLean sort of establishes a kind of precedent, not a standard exactly, but a sort of, you know, if McLean is going to do this, then I'm not going to sell out my people by, you know, standing to attention to that rag. Now, I'm not saying that was what's going through his head.
My first reaction, I'll be honest, my first reaction was when I saw him, I was like, yeah, gobshite, just face it or whatever. But then, like, it's his choice. So, like, leave him to it. Like, it's not, it's on the Belfast Telegraph, but, like, who cares?
Yeah, you didn't get a great sense of any anger in the ground.
And it's noting, Pat Flynn, who used to play for Rovers and would be a Rovers cult hero because he's a lunatic.
I saw his tweet, but I wasn't sure if he was.
He'd be dead serious. This is Alan Manus' second spell at Rovers. Like, Manus would have been at the club under, say, Michael O'Neill and stuff. And he was saying how kind of there was a few of them, like Gary Twigg, obviously from Scotland and stuff, but Pat Flynn would have been in charge of, say, all the music at Rovers. And
well,
like,
do you want me to read this tweet here? Because I saw this on the way in. Patrick Flynn says, one or two. I used to play in the same team as Alan Manus. See, this is why I didn't know if he's doing a kind of a Killian Sheridan here. Killian Sheridan tweets during games stories that are not true. So maybe they are, but usually he's made them up. He says, I used to play in the same team as Alan Manus. I was in charge of the music. I would always play Rebel songs because that was the culture. After about 8 months of battering him with these songs, he was in the dressing room showers by himself, and we all heard him singing the Rebel song, A Nation, once again. When he got out, we all stood up as a show of respect and clapped. See, this is where I started thinking. Yeah.
I reckon there's a bit of license there.
It wasn't because this staunchly Protestant man had sung one of our songs. We clapped him to show him how impressed we were with the size of his above-average manhood.
Yeah.
So I wasn't sure. But you're saying you think this is an event that took place.
Jump to actually WhatsApp him now and see if it's legit and get.
Okay, I'm just not sure. I'm not sure how happy Manus would be that it's been revealed. Well, look, it's Rebel songs.
It's out there already. You know, look, the Rebel songs, and I suppose
But that comes like a little point on that. Like in dressing rooms, it doesn't matter if you're say Protestant or Catholic, and in life it doesn't obviously. But like, once you're successful, like lads in a group, like they just will rinse each other.
Yeah.
Let's be honest, Alan Manus wasn't that wasn't him sticking two fingers up to everyone in that stadium saying, I'm not standing for your flag. He doesn't see it as his anthem. He doesn't see it as his flag.
The audience is not the audience in the stadium or whatever. It's the audience back home. Like, you know what I mean? They're the ones. That's where he could potentially have a problem if someone says, "What's he doing?"
But there were some pictures of him as well. Apparently, he turned up to the ground in a suit wearing a poppy. But I don't know if that's actually like legit. There were some pictures of him going around, and people were upset about that. But then you're like, "Oh my god!" Like, I just can't be dealing with that. Like,
well, speaking of Twitter rows, David, I understand you had a bit of backlash to your article today, which suggested that this is a genuine rivalry now between Shamrock Rovers and Dundalk. Some Dundalk fans aren't as convinced about that.
I know, just getting like a couple of messages just saying, because I basically described it as the start of what could be kind of the next big rivalry in the League of Ireland. You've had Dundalk Cork for the last 5 years, and now it seems that Rovers are definitely coming a little bit now for Dundalk. Well, they are. Like, they finished second, they were 11 points off. Dundalk were by far the better team in the league, but like, you've got a few bob coming into the league now with Rovers, with Dermot Desmond. Like, he's put in a few quid with the youth set up with Rovers, but that's sort of set a bit of a marker. And obviously you have the Americans at Dundalk, but yeah, I just made this point that it's clear now that these are going to be the two rivals, and then just getting battered literally getting almost like my article kind of dissected line by line, as if like, what are you talking about? And at one point I was asked, was I like kind of on the piss in Jackie Bourne's local or something? Which is a bit harsh. But this is the same club.
The rivalry simmered throughout a league campaign in which the Lilywhites finished 11 points clear.
I know.
Sorry, checks notes. And it came to the boil in dramatic circumstances.
I had 900 words to write, so I had to write something. But on this, right, of course they're rivals. Like, they are first and second. Even if Dundalk win the league, like, their biggest game last year was Rovers. And you can guarantee that Dundalk are going to be looking at Rovers next season. And Rovers are already talking, let's be honest, they're very good at it, talking about winning the league again next season. Like, it was the first thing Joey O'Brien said after the game when we spoke to him, when he just said, it comes back to what we were saying earlier about, like, kind of this is the start or something, but like, he's like, we need to challenge for the league and win the league. And they didn't really, they haven't properly challenged, even though they did finish second. Dundalk were always a good bit in front, but like, it can change so quickly. And like, next season's going to be, if it comes back to Jack Bourne, if Rovers can keep this group of players together, they will definitely push Dundalk.
You sound like you're quite impressed with the Rovers PR machine, which suckered myself and Ken into head along to the bizarre game and Rovers had 2 players sent off in the first half, if I remember correctly.
Oh yeah, I think it was 9 men at half time.
Yeah.
Bowes ended up winning that.
Oh yeah, that was a good game, actually, remember that.
Yeah. It was tough for Jack Byrne to play his best stuff at that day with the 2 men less.
But what do you think then, Dave? I mean, if you obviously see it as a Dundalk Rovers rivalry, but you know what is the potential here of other clubs? I mean, what about the Avocado Munchers at Bohemians, St. Ratrick's Athletic, my local boys, Shelburne, she sells seashells.
It's going to be interesting. Like,
Cork City, they've always got a team.
Yeah, well,
they've always got a team. That's
high praise. They've got a team.
So what do you think? What is the potential? Because it does feel to me as though this, like, the attendance yesterday was 33,000. So it's been going up at this cup final for the last few years. The season in general just seems to have had more buzz about it. I feel this. Like, I don't know if maybe this is inaccurate.
A couple of the clubs seem to have gotten on top of the social media aspect of it. And you're joking about the Rovers PR, but you have to fight fight your corner, and you have to put it out there. It seems like, and Bowes seem to have, a lot of them, you know, Bowes seem to have great attendances from early on.
Like, 100%. And it's not, obviously you have to do stuff on social media and all the rest of it, but like Bowes Rovers in Dublin, and like Pats to a degree, Pats can do so much more, but I know they're doing a lot of community work. But Bowes and Rovers are like pretty much the model in how they do things. Like, as much as we're saying about the Avocado and stuff, but like,
that's the sort of derisive stuff that I see.
Like, we say the cup final, about the attendance for a cup final, so it was 33,000, and it is fantastic. But at the moment in Ireland, the culture isn't of young people to go and watch League of Ireland matches. But Bowes have been great at doing that. Like, they are really kind of getting their club invested in, say, the community. But also, like, it's part of, like, it's the ritual. And that's what football is. Like, you're not going to just, there's so much stuff about cup finals, talking about gimmicks and all the rest of it. And I know, obviously, the All-Ireland League could be something that seems to be kind of by the wayside now. But, like, you're not going to get anywhere with gimmicks. It has to be built on substance. And that's what Bowes have done. And that's another club. They haven't got the money. Like, they're going to get a bit of a fill up now with the European money. They qualify for Europe. They haven't got the money of a Rovers or a Dundalk. But for the last couple of years under Keith Long, they've just made progress constantly on the pitch and off the pitch. Like, there's always a buzz. And that they've maintained. I remember I wrote a piece at the back end of last season, or the season before, couldn't mean the start. Anyway, and Daniel Lambert, who would be kind of like a commercial officer with Bowes, had a pop at me, just basically saying that, because I was making the point that, yeah, everything's gone great because the club were doing well. Like, they were kind of in the semi-final of the cup, but you can't keep on losing your best players. And eventually that buzz will fade if they're dropping down. But the way Bowes are going about it, obviously there will be a natural little bit of a drop-off if they're not being successful, but they really have seemed to have tapped into a kind of a demographic or whatever it is of just people who, like, follow that club properly. Like, it's not based on gimmicks or just here's free tickets and all the rest of it. It's they are part of those fans' Friday nights. That's their weekend, you know, and that's what football is, because I said, like, it's, it has to be the culture, like, yeah, not just fucking gimmicks, you know.
Yeah, no, well said. Listen, David, always good to have you in. Thanks a million.
No, what?
Never forget the true nature of this city.
Listen, you screwheads. Here is a man who would not take it anymore. A man who stood up against the scum, the dogs, the filth. Here is someone who stood up.
And this bike, by the way, I'd only had for 2 weeks. What happened to it? Dublin happened to it. Dublin has kicked the shit out of the bike.
There was a few minutes when I blithely believed that I lived in a civilized city. I arrived home. It was already dark. There was rain and mud everywhere.
Oh my God, this town!
So I thought to myself, no need to drag my bike through the house, given that all I'm doing is, you know, getting changed and getting my stuff and going to the pool. So I'll just leave it here beside the front door. Not on the street. I was in the house for probably for 8 to 10 minutes.
What tobacco is it? I don't know. I haven't put tobacco in ages. Just give me some.
And there's nobody on the street. And it's dark. And there's not even any foot traffic. Open the door. Bike's gone.
Oh my God, this town!
It's actually been taken from outside my front door in an 8-minute period of being unguarded. And this bike, by the way, I'd only had for 2 weeks.
This bike was given to me by my brother.
Oh my God, this town.
And I'm thinking, why? What happened to it?
Dublin happened to it.
Never forget the true nature of this city.
I'll tell you one man who thought the whole Alan Manus row was being overplayed. That's Richie Sadler, who said he's free to stand wherever he likes, focus on his performance, FFS. Yeah, that's the kind of straight talking that has made Richie Sadler's players' chair the institution it is fast becoming. There's a brand new episode due out this week, but the Mick McCarthy rule prevents me from divulging any more details at this time. To be honest, I've already gone too far. But just wanted to tee that one up for you. What I can guarantee is a Wednesday announcement of how to get tickets for the Gang's All Here live shows in December. That's going to be on the World Service this week, and a Champions League podcast on Thursday, and loads more besides that. So plenty of reason to be a member or become a member on secondcaptains.com. Thanks for today, Ken.
Thank you for today. Thank you so much. Great. It's great to see you.
Yeah, no, always good to see you.
That's the second time it's gone off.
They never go home. Those boys.
Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much, but when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you. Normally, being a little extra can be a bit much. But when it comes to healthcare, it pays to be extra. And United Healthcare makes it easy with Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they supplement your primary plan, helping you manage out-of-pocket costs without the usual requirements and restrictions like deductibles and enrollment periods. So when it comes to covering your medical bills, you can feel good about being a little extra. Visit uh1.com to find the Health Protector Guard plan for you.